Welcome to Social Justice Matters, a podcast from Social Justice Ireland. I'm Colette Bennett, Research and Policy Analyst at Social Justice Ireland. Hopefully you and yours are keeping safe and well in these strange and unprecedented times in which we're living. Our podcast series contains a number of recent interviews dealing with the current COVID-19 pandemic. We've had interviews with Tom MacDonald at the Nevin Economic Research Institute on the economic response, with Orla Hegarty of UCD on housing implications, with Bernard Joyce of the Irish Traveller Movement for International Traveller and Roma Day, with Maeve Bateman of Financial Justice Ireland on Third World Debt, and with our own CEO, Sean Healy, on the Fine Gael Fianna Fáil framework document. We've been delighted with the response to these episodes and we really appreciate the support of our listeners. In this latest edition of our podcast, I'm interviewing Dearan Ansbrough and Liz Farries of the Irish Council for Civil Liberties on the emergency measures legislation, the data protection implications of the crisis, and what this all means from a civil liberties perspective. I hope you enjoy it.
So just to start, I'd like to welcome my guests this evening, Dearan Ansbrough and Liz Farries from the Irish Council for Civil Liberties. So thank you again so much for taking the time to chat with me this evening.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
The reason I asked you along, I suppose, was to discuss the civil liberties implications of the various measures that are being taken by the Irish government in respect of this whole COVID-19 pandemic. So there's been various pieces of legislation between the acts themselves and the statutory instruments putting those pieces in place. So can you expand, I suppose, Dearan, to you first, on what this legislation actually does?
Sure. I think it was the 12th of March that the Taoiseach made the first announcement that there were going to be restrictions and that they're going to introduce emergency legislation to allow for the restrictions, essentially. And kind of from the get-go, we were going out and saying, you know, it's very clear that our human rights will still apply, even during a time of emergency, because our constitution only allows itself to be suspended during an armed rebellion or a conflict. And the European Convention of Human Rights is essentially the same, but there has to be a declaration of derogation if they are to decide that a certain right no longer sort of applies, and then certain rights are non-derogable. So we were kind of saying from the outset, you know, whatever legislation does pass has to still comply with human rights law. And that means that where you are restricting rights, it has to be, those restrictions have to be necessary and proportionate to a legitimate aim and provided for by law. So when they passed the legislation, they were kind of meeting the first aspect of that test, which is provided for by law. And so it was the following Wednesday, it was the day after St. Patrick's Day, they published a piece of emergency legislation called the Health Act 2020, is sort of the short form, but it was the Health Preservation and Protection and Other Emergency Measures in the Public Interest Bill 2020 at the time, and now, of course, it's an act. So when they published that, we sort of read through it and did an analysis of it from a human rights perspective. And essentially, we thought it was a little bit short on human rights language. And we almost immediately did a submission. We spent a day drafting the submission and got it into the government and got it into the various members of the TDs and members of the Dáil and members of the Seanad. And the legislation very quickly went into debate. It was the following day, it was Thursday, the 19th of March, it went into the Dáil, passed by the Dáil, and Friday it was passed by the Seanad. And we had also made a submission with suggested amendments. So essentially the piece of legislation is divided into four parts. The first part is kind of talks about the sort of administrative side, like how long the legislation is going to last for. And what it said at the time was that it kind of set out a vision that it could be that it would last until around the 9th of May, but it included a provision whereby the government, without parliamentary scrutiny, without going back to the Dáil, could extend the restrictions that the law provided for essentially indefinitely. So that was our first kind of red flag. We were like, whenever there's emergency legislation, it's very clear from other experiences, both in Ireland and in other jurisdictions, that where you're introducing new law in the time of an emergency, which significantly has an impact on rights, there has to be a clear end date. So we argued for what's called a sunset clause, which means that this legislation actually will, it essentially has a sell-by date. And now it was a key piece of the advocacy we did that week that was successful. So almost everybody in the Dáil and almost everybody in the Seanad, well, by the time we got to the Seanad, it was a new point, because in the Dáil, Simon Harris himself put forward the amendment for a sunset clause. And what they did was they said, this legislation only lasts until the 9th of November. And then if we want to continue on beyond then, we have to come back to the Dáil and have essentially a proper debate.
An interesting piece in it, and just in reading the legislation the week before last, the provisions around the social welfare payment.
I know, correct, and you know that's something we're really going to be keeping an eye on as well, because you know if you've still got these stringent restrictions in place where people aren't able to go to work, you know, pubs are still closed, the events can't happen. You know, there needs to be some kind of connection to the social welfare support. So I suspect that's going to be a significant area of kind of controversy going into the summer. And we've already heard them say they can only afford 3 months of social welfare as they're currently paying. So I suspect there'll be a lot of, you know, discontent around that. And I mean, it does make sense though. Like if you're going to continue the restrictions, there should be a sort of corresponding support system in place. So that's one to watch for sure.
Absolutely. I mean, we're hearing talk of tapering already. And as you've said, like the lack of affordability kind of into the longer term. But really, and, you know, outside of the context of this direct conversation, but, you know, when we can borrow at such a low level and when we haven't really explored our tax options, you know, it's quite a statement to make when, as you say, people are still locked down. They can't physically get to work. You know, and to remove those very low, you know, reasonable but low levels of payment, they have knock-on effects in terms of the poverty and the deprivation that exists then following on from cuts in pay.
Absolutely. And I suppose just on that point, and we can come back to it afterwards when we kind of talk about the future, but I think, you know, it's the rapidness of the government's response, where they were able to, from the very beginning, I think it was the 9th of March, a week before the legislation was actually passed, they were able to put in place these kind of social welfare supports. And it does beg the question, like, if it's possible now, why isn't it possible in general, you know? And at the end of the day, it kind of goes back to a sort of a policy and the legal question, where from a policy perspective, you know, the government often tries to put things forward you know, that their hands are tied financially, and they're sort of masking the fact that this is actually a policy decision you're making not to invest in housing, for example, or not to, you know, create better supports from a social welfare perspective. So it's something I think that is going to come under increased scrutiny. And the reason I say it's a legal question as well as a policy question is that, you know, in our constitution, we have very strong protections for civil liberties, essentially. But when it comes to economic and social rights, we just have sort of, pardon?
We have very little.
We have very little, yeah. So, you know, that's, I think, it, you know, the courts have generally taken the view that economic and social rights come under the umbrella of government policy rather than constitutional legal rights. And I think going forward, especially to keep in step with developments in other countries, and to keep, you know, to ensure we're in line with our international human rights obligations, in particular the International Covenant of Economic and Social and Cultural Rights, we need to start really looking at that again. So that's a little bit of a side road, but
it's certainly relevant, I suppose, to everything in the broader context of what's happening. So you talked a bit about your own submission, you know, for the Irish Council for Civil Liberties. Were you happy, or at least satisfied, that the concerns that you had in the bill, that they were actually adequately addressed by the time the Act was brought in?
Well, I think the short answer to that is no, because, you know, beyond the sunset clause, there were no actual amendments at that stage. So just to kind of very quickly summarise what's in the Act, you know, you have the first part, which is essentially administrative, talking about the end clause. The second part is about social welfare payments. The third part is about restrictions on movement and restrictions on events. And the fourth part is about the power of a medical officer to detain someone. And I think what's interesting about the law is that it's actually amending an existing law, which dates back to 1947, the Health Act, which was, I think, legislated for at the time to deal with TB. So it's essentially about the extra powers government can have to deal with an infectious disease. And there was already like a significant existing powers on the statute books for the government, but they considered they had to significantly expand those powers. So in section 3, it specifically said the government has, the Minister for Health has the right to make orders or regulations, essentially confining people to their home, it's placing limits on movements and placing limits on events. And what we kind of said about that section was it needed extra tightening in terms of the language, because in order to ensure that the restrictions on our rights to freedom of assembly, freedom of association, which essentially is about the right to meet with each other and the right to meet in public, and of course the right to free movement, all those limits have to be, as I said at the beginning, necessary, proportionate. So in the law we were getting the first step, which is prescribed by law, but we didn't feel that there was enough emphasis on the fact that when the minister was making the regulations, they had to be demonstrably necessary in response to a need, and they had to be proportionate to that need. So we asked for more language around that. We didn't get it. And then in section 4, which was about the power to detain, again, that was expanding powers already in existence in the Health Act from 1947, but it actually expanded those powers further as well. So in 1947, they had given the right to the chief medical officer to essentially authorize the detention of someone who refused to, you know, what we're calling self-isolate now. This legislation went further and basically said any medical officer could essentially detain someone and ask the Gardaí to help them detain someone. And significantly, they took away some of the safeguards that were in the existing legislation, such as a right to appeal. So we recommended they bring back in that right to appeal, and we recommended additional safeguards. For example, currently, the patient who is detained can ask for a second review by one other medical officer. And we were saying, you know, there needs to be a clarity there whereas in the law that the first medical officer must inform them of that right, and where somebody hasn't got capacity to sort of fully understand, there needs to be an advocate appointed. And that's kind of an ongoing debate, I think, from the mental health perspective. But so, yeah, we were asking for additional safeguards and tightening of language, but we didn't get that either. the one thing is, though, when they did bring in the regulations, ultimately, a very clear line we had said in our submission was that when they are talking about confining someone to their home and placing restrictions on movement, there needed to be a reasonable excuse clause, like a very clear reasonable excuse clause. And that is in the regulations once they were drafted a few weeks later. So that was a positive, you know, it was great to see that. And I think, you know, there's a lot of discretion actually within the regulations as to what constitutes a reasonable excuse to leave your home. While there are lists of what could be considered a reasonable excuse, like to get shopping, essential services, go to your essential place of work, it's what's called a non-exhaustive list, which means that there is room for interpretation. So anyway, that's sort of a roundup of what was in it and what happened. There was a lot of people who referred to our submission, and in the Shannon in particular, some of the senators were saying, you know, if this wasn't emergency legislation, we would be pushing for these amendments, but we're recognizing the fact that the country is in an emergency period and it's urgent that we get these give the government this power to restrict. So it was kind of interesting to hear them say that. Sorry,
just to say, like, it is one of those things that so many people, and I think we're probably at risk in the next number of weeks, you know, if this continues past next week, that it's starting to wane a little bit. But yeah, for the vast majority of people, it was just accepted that this is something that we need to do to keep safe. We've been told to do it. We do what we're told. And, you know, yes, there are underlying things that need to be looked at. And that's why, I suppose, organisations like yourselves exist, to really kind of get to the nuts of that. But that, I think people kind of took it on as being something that we needed to do, and whether that was kind of opposition parties or whether it was just general public, it was something that was kind of accepted. But I do think, you know, if we see an extension past the 5th of May, which is next week, the likelihood is that that, you know, we can already kind of see it, that the cracks will start to show. Are there things, if those, you know, because you've touched on pieces already, that there are powers there. They're not widely used at the moment, but there are additional measures that can be taken. What kind of things is your organization going to be watchful of, you know, as this continues?
Yeah, I mean, I think a key aspect of this whole thing is the fact that we have such an extensive policing operation, and the fact that there were so many additional powers given to the Gardaí in the initial legislation. That was another sort of few, we had talked about that aspect as well, you know, that potentially the punishment for contravening a what's called a penal provision is quite extreme compared to other countries, you know. So in France, you know, I think it's €200 if you contravene the regulations. Here it can be up to 2,500, you know, or 6 months in prison. So it's quite an extensive punishment. And we'd also suggested initially that, you know, this should be kind of a civil fine thing rather than creating these criminal offences. Mm. And so, you know, obviously that didn't happen. The criminal offences were created. And so what we've been saying since then is we've been asking the Gardaí, we've been writing to the Gardaí Commissioner, we've been writing to the Minister for Justice, just saying that, like, use of these extraordinary powers where, you know, we're seeing checkpoints all over the country. The Gardaí, you have, you know, the right to ask people their name and address, and if you don't give it to them, that's a criminal offence. You can be arrested for that. You know, now if you don't follow a direction from them, you can be arrested. So really, very invasive powers. And you know, I suppose in a way, you know, whether it's because of our advocacy or a general understanding that it had to be like that, there has been an emphasis from the government and from the Gardaí Commissioner that they're trying to police by consent rather than by coercion. Now, like, we've been hearing from members of the public about a number of concerning behaviours from the Gardaí across the country. And we actually wrote to the Gardaí Commissioner yesterday outlining a series of concerns, including the fact that people have seen armed Gardaí at checkpoints. You know, they're asking for ID and they actually don't have a legal power to ask for ID beyond their existing powers. And the existing powers essentially is confined to road traffic incidents. So if you're, you know, they can ask for your driving license. And if they suspect someone is a non-national, they have a pretty controversial power to ask them for their ID. So there's other issues as well. You know, we saw last week an inconsistent approach to protesters. You know, we had these protesters outside Debenhams who were, you know, told out of the blue that the Debenhams wasn't going to reopen, something like 3,000 people are going to lose their jobs. And they organized a very kind of small and respectful protest, you know, where
they were socially distant,
and I think they were wearing masks as well, you know, last week. And this, they were told by the Gardaí they had to leave, they were not allowed to speak to journalists, and they were escorted to buses. So that's kind of, you know, really creeping kind of police, an extension of their given powers, let's say. So we're kind of, we wrote again about that and we highlighted it. And I think, you know, hopefully we're going to see a more consistent approach to that. And I think, you know, going forward, depending on what happens next week, I know the cabinet is split. They are saying today about whether or not they are going to extend the restrictions. I do understand that from a health perspective, what the doctors are saying is that, look, if we raise all the restrictions next week, we might undo all the good work we've done over the last month in flattening the curve. You know, we might, all the sacrifice, the social sacrifice, the economic sacrifice might be for nothing if we lift them too soon. So, like, we understand that. But there's a couple of points that we're really emphasizing. And one is that whatever the government does in order to comply with those factors that I've mentioned a couple of times already, the proportionality, the necessity, they have to ensure that what they're recommending or what they're requiring us to do is in line with the current health advice. That's very key. You know, they can't go beyond that. They can't sort of make And also there needs to be more transparency in their decision-making. And it's a key principle of human rights as well, that government decision-making has to be transparent. So we'd like to see more of that. We'd like to understand a little bit better how the national health team are making the recommendations. Who are they talking to? Who are they, you know, who's making the ultimate decisions, you know? So there's pushing for that.
There's been some discussion in relation to the fact that, you know, records of discussions at governmental level aren't being kept as they would in the usual way, because everything is happening so fast. And yeah, that seems to stretch, I suppose, the requirements of the pandemic a little bit in terms of, it doesn't take that much to make a record of who spoke to you and what did they say.
Yeah, and who was present. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, it speaks to that issue around transparency and where the influences are coming from, and not to, you know, this isn't kind of a paranoia thing. It's a basic civil liberties issue. It's a very basic right to in a democracy to know how decisions are being made, particularly when those decisions affect the fact that you can't go any more than 2 kilometres outside of your house unless you're doing kind of essential things.
Exactly, yeah.
And I mean, you put together a piece in relation to a call for a human rights assessment for the whole review of what's happening.
That's correct, yeah. We sent that into government last week with a number of other organisations as well. And essentially what it's saying is that, you know, these key principles, these human rights principles of, only restrict our rights where it's necessary and proportionate to the aim of protecting our health, make sure there's no discrimination, people are given equal access to the care they need. And there's also a fundamental principle within human rights law, which is about prioritizing support for vulnerable populations. And, you know, that's what I think one of the things that this disease has really exposed in Ireland is that fundamental, you know, inequality between certain communities. And, you know, whether it's homeless people in hostels or people seeking international protection in direct provision centres, members of the travelling community who are in halting sites without proper sanitation. You know, it's like the people who we don't generally shine a light on, these are the people who we're saying to the government, you absolutely have to. The consequences of not taking correct action are so devastating, and we saw it tragically across nursing homes, that you absolutely have to prioritise these groups in your response, you know, and whether it's, you know, through providing proper housing or sanitation or economic supports. So that would be a key ask, and that's something we're going to be monitoring over the next while as well. You know, how are these communities being looked after? Are they being prioritised? And is enough being done? So that would be that's a key thing we'll be monitoring.
Okay, thank you. And if I can turn to Liz, who has been very, very patient.
Sorry, Liz.
For our chat. Not at all.
No, not at all.
Thank you, Liz. I just want to talk about, I suppose, this whole area around data protection. So we know, or we're at least hearing, you know, discussion of a contact tracing app that makes it easier, ostensibly, to trace anybody who's been in contact with somebody who turns out to have the disease. There's also obviously implications for people who are working from home, particularly those in limited space where they're sharing, you know, office spaces or desk space with people who may not be attached to their organization and may have personal data, particularly in relation to those, say, who are working from home from state agencies or government departments or, you know, NGOs, people who have quite sensitive data, on marginalized groups or sensitive groups. And then, you know, again, the issue of the public services card has raised its head in the midst of it all as well. And we saw last week the UN rapporteur on extreme poverty and human rights, and they've weighed into the decision or into the discussion in relation to it and how, in particular, it's affecting people from marginalised groups who can't wade through the bureaucracy of it. So just to throw all of that at you, Liz, would you, you know, could you give us some, I suppose, some thoughts in relation to it and I suppose where you stand on it?
Yeah, I'm happy to. Thanks, Colette, for having me on. I work for ICCL directing a program of tech and human rights. And while I've been following ICCL advocacy on the emergency responses powers. It's actually been great to sit and have an informal chat with Erin, who is the lead on this, about all the twists and turns of the law and the historical implications. So it's been really good for me to just sit and listen tonight. And thank you both for that.
Thanks, and I'm looking forward to hearing from you as well.
Yeah, it's great. We don't see each other enough, so this is really nice. In terms of the tech questions that you've asked, Colette, I look at COVID from an online or digital rights perspective or through a tech lens, and COVID has certainly created a unique and massive struggle, which tech might help with to a limited extent. And tech is certainly being explored by the Department of Health in Ireland in terms of COVID management. And it's being explored in part through the form of an app, of a mobile phone app. And that raises a number of concerns, because apps can be accompanied by questionable levels of efficacy. And they also present high levels of risk to our rights and safety, depending on how they're deployed. And so ICCL can't speak very specifically to the HSC app, which is under development right now, and which may possibly be launched as early as the beginning of next month. And that's because we haven't seen very many details about it. And that's a problem, given the Irish government's record of mishandling data and personal information projects in the past. Particularly, you touched on one of them, the public services card, but also the data retention regime in Ireland. And so ICCL shares the concern of data protection experts in Ireland regarding the app and what's being marketed as an emergency response to COVID might in fact be developed into a more generalized monitoring app, or a super app, as Digital Rights Ireland has called it, for uses that go beyond its initially stated purpose.
I know you can't talk about the specifics, but in general terms, are we talking something along the lines of Google, where, you know, they can track how many times you've passed a particular shop and they start to kind of market things at you, or, you know, you get kind of a review at the end of the year of where you've been for the year? Is it that kind of detail? Is it more? Well,
it's funny, because Google and Apple are developing what is referred to as a decentralized app, which is actually considered by experts to be more rights respecting than what appears to be a centralized app being explored by the Department of Health. The HSC COVID Tracker Ireland app may have three functions: to help promote contact tracing, which can be done in a rights respecting decentralized way. They're not appearing to explore that option now, but they're also looking to look at location tracking, so keeping track of where people go from here to there. And they're also looking to track symptom reports. So that's three sort of separate functions being rolled into one big app. And that extends beyond sort of the more risk-averse and cautious app, which is simply the contact tracing app. And so that creates a lot of concerns. And given that, ICCL is joining a group of civil rights organizations, of scientists and academics, who are in the process of writing an open letter outlining our concerns for the app. And we're warning primarily that there's still insufficient evidence that contact tracing alone, not these other parts of the app, but the more conservative part of the app, there still isn't very strong evidence that even that actually works. My understanding that there are about 30 countries right now that have rolled out contact tracing in one form or another, and we still don't have robust data from any of those sources about the efficacy of the app. So there's the worry that the app isn't even going to help, and then there are these other concerns that the app in Ireland might not be lawful, it might not be human rights compliant, and it might not be transparent. You were talking earlier about the need for public engagement and transparency. That certainly applies here, and we're not seeing it.
Can we touch on, I suppose, and I know you're primarily from a kind of a digital perspective. This whole concept of working from home and, you know, just how much data is now in people's homes, where, you know, it would have been unheard of to take large, well, it should be unheard of to take large swathes of personal data, of client data, of service user data into your house.
Yeah, yeah. I would say from a data protection perspective, depending on the protocols that are deployed, working from home can create a lot of security vulnerabilities. And this can be bad for organizations themselves, but it can also be bad for more vulnerable members that organizations deal with. And I can speak to this most closely as a member of an international network of civil liberties organizations. So INCLO is a group of independent NGOs from across the globe. And the position of ICCL as a member of this network is actually much more secure here in Ireland than the position of some of our colleagues who have been made more vulnerable by more autocratic regimes where the rule of law is under serious attack right now. And so in situations like this, secure data protocols are absolutely essential. Not so much for, you know, so for example, ICCL, but for the people that we're talking to. And so there are a number of behavioral and software choices that organizations can make in order to mitigate risk and also to ensure compliance with, you know, the Data Protection Act and the GDPR. And there are very helpful sort of human rights technologist organizations that give advice along those lines. And
the Data Protection Commissioner herself, her office has issued guidance on it, on working from home and the implications of it. You're smiling, Liz.
Well, I've been to the Data Protection Commissioner's office, and it's a beautiful office, but it's sort of an older building. And I often wondered, you know, what their remote working arrangements were of the DPC in light of the building itself. So, I mean, yes, I would say the DPC is an authority to refer to if organizations are looking about what not to do and what to do. And it's interesting because even the DPC currently is very likely practicing what they preach.
The issue in relation to the public services card, you know, the fact, and like myself and Darren were talking earlier about, you know, the fact that there's an acknowledgement with the COVID payment of the €350 and the speed with which that was, you know, brought in. But there is that acknowledgement that people have a particular need, that you shouldn't have to wait those 3 days to get a payment when you've been put out of work. That the level of the payment is a kind of tacit acknowledgement of the fact that €203 perhaps isn't sufficient to live on. And with this, with the payment services card or the public services card, sorry, again, there is that kind of oblique acknowledgement of the fact that this is a very bureaucratic process. And you don't need it in an emergency. So where does that leave us?
Yeah, I'm really glad you're saying that. To me, that point seems very obvious. That was certainly the point made by UN expert on poverty, Philip Alston. Certainly the point of ICCL. It's not clear to me that the Department of Social Protection has acknowledged that point. But yes, it is very clear. Like, one of the major ways that the public service card scheme has been marketed, there's two ways. One way, though, is that it has streamlined and made efficient complex social welfare services, that it improves efficiency in addition to, you know, combating welfare fraud and the bad guys out there are seeking to cheat the system. Both claims are really spurious, but COVID has, I think, demonstrated very clearly that the first claim is incorrect, that the PSC scheme does not streamline services, does not make things more efficiency. And Professor Alston certainly reinforced that in his letter, that it instead actually creates an undue burden on social welfare recipients.
Absolutely. And I suppose to wrap up for both of you, and I really, really do appreciate all of your time this evening, what happens next? So, you know, what from a civil liberties perspective should the new normal actually look like? What happens when the emergency measures are no longer in effect? Where do we go from here?
Well, I mean, we would be hoping that we go back to, our normal rights, that we have freedom of movement, we can meet each other and we can gather together in public. I think there's, you know, we have to recognise that this isn't going to go away in, you know, a day. there's no, as I think I read somewhere saying they switched on the restrictions like a switch. They're not going to be able to switch them off. It's going to have to be in phases. But I think we're just going to be really trying to monitor and making sure that, as I said, each stage is, you know, we're basically lifting those restrictions as much as we can in line with the health advice, and that they shouldn't go on in any way longer than are necessary. And of course, I think it probably will mean that we'll all have to accept that some things aren't going to happen for a while. You know, we all know there's no festivals over 5,000 people going to be happening this summer, which I think really devastated a lot of music fans. But, you know, so we accept that that's probably necessary, you know, in terms of, you know, restaurants and pubs, it may be that there's more, you know, less tables and there's social distancing. And, you know, I mean, I think this crisis is so unprecedented that there's like nobody really knows exactly what's going to happen over the next few months, over the next year. And all we can really do is just ensure that, you know, the government is getting the best health advice out there. They're consulting the right people and they're basing their decisions on real evidence. Beyond that, you know, I suppose there's not really too much else we can do rather than, you know, beyond monitoring and ensuring that all of our restrictions are, the restrictions are, continue to be necessary and proportionate, my two big words. But fingers crossed. Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's important to say, though, that with the sunset clause, you know, there's going to be much more parliamentary scrutiny. The next time we have a legislative process, there's going to be a lot more parliamentary scrutiny. There's going to be a lot more space, I think, because we're not going to be at that urgent coalface for real debate, democratic debate. And I think that's going to be significant going forward as well, as transparency and democratic debate.
Thank you. And Liz, I mean, how difficult will the digital cat be to get back into a bag?
I think everything that Darren just said could certainly apply to the HSE app and its deployment. We need evidence-based solutions. We need absolute transparency. We need public consultation and a rock disengagement. So it's just like, this is a real opportunity to evaluate what our rights look like, set good frameworks going forward, not just in a time of crisis, but always, because rights tend to be obscured when it comes to the online world. And a crisis like this is actually an opportunity to really solidify what those are online in terms of the HSE app, but also offline in terms of movement and all the issues that Darren has really clearly described here.
And if I might just add one other point, you know, the Special Rapporteur on Counterterrorism was giving a joint webinar with our executive director today at virtual Queen's University. And I thought you made a brilliant point, which was really about how, you know, traditionally we've kind of allowed this separation, which is kind of a historical anomaly, of civil liberties and economic and social rights. But really, rights are indivisible. You know, it's hard to go out and protest if you haven't had a meal that morning, or, you know, you can't really express your, you know, express your views if you didn't get proper schooling, or, you know, don't have a roof over your head. So I think that's something that is being highlighted by this crisis. And it's something that I think we should all be cognizant of and sort of advocating for going forward.
Thank you very, very much. I'll leave it there. Again, thank you to Darren and thank you to Liz for your time this evening. Hopefully you'll chat again soon. Take care.
Thanks, Colette. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Colette.
Thank you for listening. If you have any suggestions for topics you'd like to see covered, whether it be interviews, our 10-minute lesson series, or some of our seminar and conference papers, please do get in touch by email at secretary@socialjustice.ie. Until next time, stay safe.